Well, thank you. We're glad to be here. We thought we would have already been here, but things happened last evening in Dallas that we weren't prepared for, and apparently the airlines weren't either. And we were glad they changed their plans and decided to fly us out early this morning. In fact, most of the flights in the Dallas-Fort Worth area were being canceled, and so we were sort of glad they chose not to put ours in the air. They offered to take us by way of St. Louis and then hopefully down to Houston to get into San Antonio, hopefully around 1 o'clock. So I said, well, hopefully we'll go early in the morning. So that's what we did. Just not long ago, I read the true story about a man who was sitting on an airplane and had been served a prepackaged meal. It was one of those quick snacks. And when he popped the little plastic lid off the sandwich and tiny little salad and the I call a airplane food toy food. It's all toy food. He had a little toy salad and a toy sandwich, and right on top of everything was this big roach. It was sitting right there, and he hit the fan. I mean, he really was angry, and they tried to apologize. Well, when he landed, he got to the hotel. He pulled off one of these Post-its. You've seen those little slips that stick to the back, and he just wrote a quick note, found the name of the president and the name of the airline, and wrote a letter to the president of the airline, and he told him what happened, and he just unloaded a piece of his mind he couldn't afford to lose. And when he mailed it, and to his amazement, when he got back from that business trip, there was a letter from the president that had been mailed in overnight mailing to him. He was impressed, and had the letterhead of the airline at the top, and it said something like, this was most unusual what happened. Do not worry. We have taken immediate action. I assure you that particular plane has been completely fumigated. All of the seats and other upholstery have been stripped out and replaced. We have taken disciplinary action against the flight attendants who served you that meal. One of them may soon lose her job. It's highly probable that this particular aircraft will be temporarily taken out of service. I assure you it will never happen again. Sincerely. And the guy signs his name at the bottom, president. The fellow thought, that is terrific. And he got ready to put the letter aside, and he noticed that his stick-on note that he had sent the president had somehow gotten stuck on the back of the letter by the secretary that typed that letter to him. And he noticed scrawled in the handwriting of the president was the comment, send this guy the standard roach letter. Isn't that a kick? Standard roach letter. Boy. Is something. Well, I want to add my voice to others who have already spoken to you here regarding how much you mean to us. It makes me smile to think about the standard roach letter. Some of you may think you're getting our standard thank you letters from the seminary. Any letter we send that says thank you is not a standard, flippant kind of piece of correspondence. You are what I frequently refer to in Christian ministries as those unseen and often unknown, but certainly not unimportant, parts of this vast iceberg, only part of which is ever observed by the public. And we want to thank you for believing in this wonderful school over the years. Some of you go way back. Others of you are just finding out about what God is doing at our school and through the ministry of Dallas Seminary around the world. We have just about turned the corner on 8,000 alumni. Remarkable. Over 70 years, a school without scandal, without once having a black eye or some skeleton rattling in a closet, some heartache that that has cut the soul out of the ministry, that's never been true. Long-term individuals that have served in this place that I now occupy. It's wonderful standing on shoulders like that. It's great knowing that there is nothing that will come as a surprise once I have been here 2 or 3 years. That finally the truth will be told. The truth has been told. We're built on the truth. We believe in the truth. Hopefully, over the years, you have learned that we model the truth. Now, when I thought about speaking to you today and knowing the value of our time together, I asked a friend of mine, what do you think would be the best thing to talk about? And he said, you know, I think they want to get to know you. I think they want to know the school, and I think probably the better they get to know you, they will discover more about the school, because the school would not have asked you, and you would certainly not be in this position to have accepted this role if you do not represent what the school is about. So I thought, what do I really believe in? What are the things that I now, at this age and at this level of my ministry, what are the things that I really, down in my soul, feel strongly about? You know, the older you get, the more you think about those kind of things. And your list sometimes gets shorter. You know, when you're younger, you die for a lot of things. But as you get older, you get a little more selective about things you'd really, really give your life for. Now, the things I want to talk about are things that I would, without hesitation, be willing, if necessary, to give my life for. And I think most of the people at our school, I'd probably say certainly our faculty and our administration, these are things that all of us would. Now, obviously, we don't have time to address all of the things, and I think probably there are 8 or 9 I put on the list when I begin to think about it. But I want to talk during my times to speak to all of you. I want to talk about 3 of those things. One was real hard to put off until another time, but we'll do that later. First of all, I really do believe in family. I'll talk about why I do a little bit later on, but that's one thing I would name. On this earth, I don't know that there's anything that grabs my attention quicker or deserves my loyalty more readily than my marriage, our roles as parents and now grandparents. We just had our 8th grandchild. He's the 5th of our boys, and we've got 3 little granddaughters, so we've got 5 little guys and 3 little gals. The role as parents, and ultimately the role and responsibility of laying up for our children. There's this verse that says, children are not to lay up parents, but parents are to lay up for their children. We don't hear about that a lot. So we'll talk briefly about that part of it. But anyway, I really believe in family. The second thing I would name is I really believe in ministry. I've been doing it for 40 years. 35 years ago, I came to the seminary. Prior to this, I was involved in evangelistic work with a couple of good friends. One of them, Jimmy Draper, was the preacher. Charles Ogilvy was another young preacher, and I was the song leader, if you can believe that. And Cynthia was a pianist, and some of our We did some scary things, Bill. We'd make you look mild, Bill, back in those days. Wonderful times in ministry. I have nothing but great memories of ministry. And when I look back over God's faithfulness over these years, I have to tell you, there are few things that bring me to tears quicker than the reminders of where God has used His Word in a wonderful way, used His Spirit to touch lives. We've been able to minister in a few churches as a pastor, and now here ministering at the seminary ministry I believe in with all my heart. Third, I would list integrity. I really believe in integrity. We do as a school. We believe we ought to do what we say, and we ought to say what we do. We ought to be authentic through and through. You ought to be able to check around our place on Tuesday afternoon and find us as faithful, believing and doing what we say we are doing on Sundays. It ought not surprise us to have anybody visited on a Thursday or Friday night and find that the very same life and lifestyle that we promote and believe in, we're carrying out. Authenticity, which goes as a twin with integrity, I really do believe in. And the fourth one, I got to wait for it later, is liberty. I really do believe in Christian liberty. I really believe in grace. And grace not only is the God's unmerited favor in giving us so graciously his Son at the cross, but I believe with that the freedom to live as the Spirit of God directs. So we'll kind of hold that out for a preview of some other attraction. Later on, we'll look at liberty. But three times I want to talk first of all about family. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 3 at that great list of qualifications for people in ministry. We really hammer away at these things when we talk to young men about becoming pastors and becoming officers in churches. We talk to men and women who are preparing for ministry. As we address the standard of that role, we look closely at the list. And there's a little parenthesis in the list that is so easily overlooked. But it really is the thin wire upon which most of the other things hang. Let's go back to the first part of chapter 3. It is a trustworthy statement if any man aspires to the office of overseer. It is a fine work he desires to do. An overseer then must be. Please notice the list. 15, 16 things. Not multiple choice, but these are essentials. He must be above reproach. He must be a one-woman man, husband of one wife. Must be temperate. He must be prudent. He must be respectable. He must be hospitable. Must be able to teach. Not addicted to wine or pugnacious, angry, a fighting kind of a temperament or attitude, but rather gentle, uncontentious, free from the love of money. He continues, he must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. Verse 6, and not a new convert. So he must be mature, must be on his way toward maturity, lest he become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. The list continues. He must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he may not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Now, I deliberately missed verse 5. That's that parenthesis. It is the only part of the list that stands as a blanket disqualification. Most people have never made that observation. Look at it. If a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? Wow. Remember the first time the heaviness of that warning landed on me. We had begun to have our family. It started during our years in seminary. We had our firstborn between the second and third year in the THM course at the school back in the early fall, really late summer. September the 4th was his birthday of 1961. Our Kurt was born. We just finished an internship with Ray Stedman out in Palo Alto, Peninsula Bible Church. Cynthia was carrying Kurt through that summer, and they flew her back, and I drove back and pulled a little U-Haul trailer with a little washing machine somebody had given us. That's another story. How many times did that thing flood our apartment there? I'll never, ever. It was either Loose Nodders or our apartment, and the apartment house leaned, and so when it did flood, it was Lou Schneider's place that got more of the water than ours. But anyway, he has long since forgiven me of that. I'll never forget. But we came back and had that first baby. I remember the enormous sense of responsibility. Remember your firstborn? Remember when you God gave you that first little girl, first little boy? I remember coming back from Baylor Hospital. We'd gone through that 8-9 hour labor and then birth. And those days you couldn't go into the birthing room. Remember? Yeah, most of you were that age where when you had your kids, they made you go sit out in the dad's den. I remember acting cool sitting out there, and one guy leaned over and said, "The newspaper is upside down." So I turned it back over, and my mind was really in the birthing room, but they didn't let us in those days. I remember coming home and thinking, I don't know how to do this. I've never been a daddy before. And this horrendous sense of responsibility. It so happened that particular year was my third year, and we were into the pastoral epistles, and I remember under the tutelage of Lewis Johnson, Dr. S. Lewis Johnson, getting into Timothy and having him put his bony finger on verse 5 and bear down. I remember sitting there thinking, if I don't know how to manage this family, I won't know how to manage the church. You know, the church is a family, isn't it? That's why words like discipline are used rather than firing. When people are out of line and live in a manner that brings reproach to Christ and their lives get so extreme that they are way out of line, disciplinary actions sometimes have to be taken. But you never fire people because it isn't a company. And the leaders of a church are never called the bosses. That's what you call them in a company. They're more like fathers. They're like shepherds. Those are family terms. And we're called brothers and sisters. Those are family words. We're not called fellow employees. The church is a family. So the point being, if you are not able to model in microcosm, in the little area of your little one or two or three children and husband or wife, how can you manage the bigger family? All the more reason, folks, when you're looking for a pastor, look closely at his family. We made it a point to always interview wives with the husbands. And if the kids were old enough to bring in the kids, it was always an interesting dynamic when we would tell the fellow we were interviewing, "We'd like to talk with your kids now." It was always an interesting experience. But we found out some wonderful things about their family life, which helped us know more about how that person would be as a manager in his own home and family. Now, we're not talking about ministry today so much as your family and my family. So, because we are representing a school, I'm going to give you a little quiz. All right? All of you look so comfortable until this moment. Take out a piece of paper, nice blank piece of paper, somewhere find room with your pen, your pencil, to grade yourself on this little quiz I'm going to give you. I love giving quizzes, and this is a little surprise quiz you didn't know you'd be taking. So here's how we're going to do it. Now, husbands cannot take the quiz for their wives, and wives cannot take quizzes for their husbands, so you got to take the quiz for yourself, and then when we're all through, your neighbor is going to grade your paper. Just kidding. Just joking. What I want you to do is take the left-hand margin and write down the words family life, okay? At the top, put an F. Below it, put an A. And then an M. Spell out family and then the word life. Should come to 10 letters unless you don't spell well. Family life should be on the left margin of your quiz, all right? Now, these 10 letters are going to represent 10 areas of family life that seem to be important, at least to the Swindolls, and I think they will all be considered important to you as well. So let's take a quiz, and you grade yourself. 10 being the best and 1 being the worst, I want you to grade your own family In these 10 areas, I'm going to give you that will begin with the word, the letters F and A and M and I and so on down. Okay, here we go. I want you to give yourself a grade. Now, if you're not married, you might want to grade the family you were raised in. That might be a good family to fall back on. But right now, if you are, grade your own family. F represents, and write it down, flexibility and freedom. That's the word I want you to put there. The F represents flexibility / freedom. On a scale of 1 to 10, and only you can answer this, no one else knows, is there in your family openness, vulnerability, willingness to flex at certain times? Someone gets sick, so somebody has to pick up the load and carry a little more. Some go off to college, the others have to pitch in. You have to give as well as take in your family. Is the atmosphere of freedom there as well? Some of you have given yourself a grade real quick. Listen to the rest of this. The atmosphere of freedom. Is there room for new thinking? Open conversation. Are you willing to try out new ideas with one another without getting shot down? Is there the freedom to disagree, to talk things through, to work things out without anybody being condemned, put down, or judged? On a scale of 1 to 10, give yourself a grade. Okay? And we're going to add them up in a minute and see how you did. So you put your number down. Number 2, or A, affirmation and appreciation. Write the words affirmation / appreciation. This has to do with a positive attitude in your family. Is there an absence of negative put-downs and sarcasm? Do you find yourself fairly free of wrangling? Now, you're going to have disagreements, okay? So don't sit there feeling guilty because you have an argument with your mate. That's not uncommon. We won't use any illustrations here, but that's not uncommon. Just take it by faith. Do you feel in your family valued and affirmed? Do you feel a person of worth from your mate? And is there that same reciprocal feeling on her part or his part? You're supposed to grade yourself. That's a great question. That will make a massive difference in the score, I might add, too. Yes, we already have questions and we haven't even finished. Yes.
So this is not between brothers.
This between you and your mate and you and your children and et cetera. You had a question. Let's go present. Let's not try to add to our guilt, okay? The further back you go, the worse it gets. So let's stay with today. We've learned a lot over these years, so we'll give ourselves room to have grown. Yes, why don't I have you ask the questions today? Yes, you have a question.
Is it our own behavior or our family as a unit?
Family as a unit. Yeah, that makes it harder, doesn't it? You have to grade the atmosphere in your home. This is family life. Bill has a question.
This is just like in seminary.
It is. You start that. What they're trying to do is keep me from giving the quiz. I'm not falling for it. The M is the third, okay? M represents maturity / stability. On a scale of 1 to 10, can you solve problems together? Do you remain fairly stable under pressure? The words are maturity and stability. Can you work through times of crisis and maintain reasonable calm? Now, you got to grade a little on the curve in some places. I know some days are better than others. Let's leave it just the general broad brush picture, okay? On a normal year, a given year, we're not talking about some awful tragedy that strikes. We'll give you all the room you need in times like that. I'm talking about the general give and take of a year, ups and downs, the yo-yo of experience. How do you do in the level of, or in the area of maturity and stability? Okay, I represents integrity / character. Is your home a place that upholds honesty? Do you tell the truth? You have high ethical and moral standards. Are things like hard work and honest communication and the keeping of promises valued? If you do wrong, do you say so? Is there an apology, sincere apology, a willingness to forgive on the other side? That all of that is in the mix of integrity and character. Okay, moving right along. L represents love. Love and commitment. Is your family supportive? You stick together? You stay beside one another when things get stormy? Is love demonstrated in things like touching, hugs, affection, true demonstration of affection? When your mate fails, are you still there for her, for him? That's commitment. They don't have to succeed to win your love. It's there. Why? It would be yearly events, activities. We call them traditions in our home. Does your family occasionally return to the same place? Do you have holiday traditions? Are there memory-making events that cause those traditions to keep alive and vibrant? Okay, we're over halfway through. Let's go to the word life, family life. L is leadership. Rate yourself 1 to 10. Do you feel there's fair and consistent leadership in the home? Ideally from both parents who work together, you and your mate. Are you available? Are you reasonable? Is there strong discipline when there needs to be strong discipline? In your leadership, are you fairly creative with your ideas? Are you decisive when you need to be? It's time to make a decision. Good leaders don't go past that time. They make it. And more often than not, you're right in your leadership. You know exactly where your family stands on those major issues. That's a reflection of good leadership. The next letter is I. Let's call this interest in spiritual things. Interest in spiritual things. Is there an absence of religious hypocrisy and empty cliches in the presence of authentic love for Christ and His Word? Is there prayer? The ministry of the church. Are you involved in that? Are you regularly there? Your giving goes to the church. Your time. What you're able to do by way of leadership, maybe serving in some capacity in the church. You've got the picture. F, fun. Fun, relaxation, leisure. Do you have fun? Is the home the enjoyable place to be? Is laughter heard? Tension released through fun times together? Now, every family handles this in different ways. Some play sports together. Some attend sports together. Some watch sporting events together. Some people do things as a team. Some of them do as, you know, two of the kids do things together. And not everybody does. But for the most part, there is an emphasis placed on fun. Hey, this is a good point to add, a good place to add. Do you really take your vacations? Do you really take time off? I don't mean you all do it together, though you may. I mean, do you really honor the value of recreation, leisure? Life isn't just kind of a grim existence for your family. And E is expressive. Expressive. Do you talk openly at home? Are you as good at listening as you are speaking? Instead of fighting things out, do you talk them out? Again, as I said, it's not that there's never disagreement. You can share your dreams and your ideas and your frustrations because you are expressive. Here's another one. Do you really speak the truth openly and in love? There's tact. in your openness. Okay. All right, it's time to grade your own quiz. Add up your score. Pass it to the person sitting behind you. No. You look at that. You qualify as a fourth member of the Trinity if you're 100, okay? So nobody makes 100 in this room. Let's say your score is below 30. All right? There is a lot of room for improvement. You need to listen real well today if you scored below 30. If you scored 30 to 50, I would say you are more unhappy and unfulfilled at home than you may have thought you were. Things need to be talked out and worked through. If you scored a 50 to a 75, you have an above average home, in my opinion. I commend you if you are in that level. Stay at it. If you are from 50 to 75. If you scored a 75 to a 90, you are way ahead of the pack of individuals I've given this quiz to. Your home should be written up. We need to find out more about how you do the things you do. If you scored over 90, two things are true. First, you should be teaching today. And second, you need to adopt Cynthia and me as your children so we can learn how you do it. This is remarkable. Isn't it interesting when you do something as objective as this, how it makes you think back and remember over the years what you have been doing? Bill Cosby's little book, Time Flies, says, in America, the seven ages of man have become preschool, Pepsi generation, baby boomer, midlifer, empty nester, senior citizen, organ donor. We are all somewhere along the way in our process together. Somebody told me just before I left Dallas, true happiness is when all the kids leave the nest, you sell the boat, and the dog dies. I know, the dog lovers hate that, but I just had to throw it in. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Let's put some meat on this skeleton we have now begun to build in our minds. Let's seek some truth for these strange times in which we live. Deuteronomy 6. Moses is the writer because Moses is the spokesperson. If you will, this is part of his journal that has become a part of the sacred text of Scripture. You can't appreciate Deuteronomy if you don't remember where it's coming from. He's about 120 years old. He's learned a lot, especially since he turned 80. Moses' life is in 40-year segments. For the first 40 years, he's in Egypt. For the next 40 years, he's keeping his father-in-law's sheep in the wilderness. And at age 80, the burning bush experience happens, and he now leads the people out of slavery toward the promised land. But he comes right to the edge, and he can go no further. So he decides to preach. And he remembers the law to the people. Deuteronomos. A repetition of the law, the second law, if you will. Looking back for a final glance at what God has taught us about himself and about the way we should live our lives. There are seven great sermons as you study the book of Deuteronomy, and this is one of the greatest ever delivered. As Moses pulls the people aside, gets the attention of the fathers of the families, and delivers his soul to them regarding their own domestic survival. I think centuries have passed since it was first delivered, and recorded, but it is though you are reading today's paper when you read what Moses writes. This is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you, your son, your grandson, might fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. Oh, Israel, you should listen. Isn't that wonderful? Oh, Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it. They're not the same, by the way. Listening and doing, one leads to the other, but they're not the same. Listen and do it. Why? That it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel. Twice in consecutive verses he refers to listening. You should listen, O Israel. Hear, O Israel. The Lord is our God. The Lord is one. Echad is the word. It means one as in cluster of a grapes. He is three in one. He is Father, Son, and Spirit. There is no other God like your God. The polytheistic people of this land that you're going to invade have no concept of your God. Your God is like no other God. He has distinctives about him that their gods do not have. And he has requirements for his people that they do not hold to, a standard of holiness that they would even mock. You see, he's concerned about them. They're on the edge of Canaan. Promised land, yes. But pagan land, idolatrous land. If you've never really been around idolatry, you can't appreciate idolatry. Appreciate in the sense of realize its impact. You're moving into a land of peoples who have never known your God. If you hope to survive living in Canaan, you're going to have to remember who God is, and what God has said, and what God expects. Shema. This is, among the Hebrews, this is known as the Shema. Wolvard and Zook, in their fine work on the Bible Knowledge Commentary, write, this verse has been called the Shema, from the Hebrew word translated hear. Shema. The statement in this verse is the basic statement of faith in Judaism. The verse means that Yahweh is totally unique. He alone is God. The Israelites could therefore have a sense of security that was totally impossible for their polytheistic neighbors. The gods of the ancient Near East rarely were thought of as acting in harmony. Each god was unpredictable and morally capricious. So a pagan worshiper could never be sure that his loyalty to one god would serve to protect him from the wrath of another. Can you imagine that? Gods in conflict with each other? Shema. This is among the Hebrews, this is known as the Shema. Wolvard and Zook, in their fine work on the Bible Knowledge Commentary, write, this verse has been called the Shema, from the Hebrew word translated hear. Shema. The statement in this verse is the basic statement of faith in Judaism. The verse means that Yahweh is totally unique. He alone is God. The Israelites could therefore have a sense of security that was totally impossible for their polytheistic neighbors. The gods of the ancient Near East rarely were thought of as acting in harmony. Each god was unpredictable and morally capricious. So a pagan worshiper could never be sure that his loyalty to one god would serve to protect him from the wrath of another. Can you imagine that? Gods in conflict with each other? So you appease one god, you anger another god. We were in China, right in the heart of this particular part of Asian idolatry. And there was this temple, you've been there, where people would come by and they would rub. Just rub it until you'd expect their hands to be irritated, and this god that they were rubbing was black with the oil of people's hands. Rubbing, 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 going back there, and they'd rub themselves. And they'd rub this god again, and they'd rub themselves. And I said to one of our friends there, "What is this?" He said, "Oh, this is their survival. They're trying to appease that god." But it was a room filled with other gods all around the room, and they were all different faces and expecting all different things. Can you imagine living under that? Now, Israelites, listen, you are 20 feet from that terrorizing idolatry, and from there on, you'll live among those people. All the more reason God told them to drive them out, which they didn't do. And as a result, you know the story. Judges. Continued cycle in failure, back to victory, back to failure, back to victory. So he says to them on the front end, it's like the talk you'd give your son before he goes to college, or your daughter, right? My son, I've been wanting to talk to you about something for a long time. I mean, day after tomorrow, you drive out of here, and you're going off to Tech. Or you're going off to A&M. Or, oh, thanks, you're going to Berkeley. Oh. Listen, son, I gotta tell you some things you're going to encounter when you get there. I know because I've been there. I know exactly what you're going to run into. The kid sits there like, when is this going to end so I can be with my friends for the last time? But you know in your heart what's best. But you're not going to be able to go. Moses is right there. He's pulled these people he loves. He's been ministering to them together. He's pulled them together, if you will, under his wing. And he said, listen, dads, listen to me. You've been leading your families over these years together. We've gone through so much together, but we've all been worshiping the same God. You are about to step into a hell on earth, unbelievable time of testing. And if you don't walk with your God, you're going to lose your distinctive. You're going to lose your way. And some of you are going to lose your life. You got it. So this is for us just as much as it is for them, because not one of us lives in a community that is totally Christian. You can't. You'd have to leave this earth in order to do that. That's why heaven continues to be such a marvelous place to anticipate. And so, in light of this kind of future, Moses unburdens his heart and gives them some guidelines. I want you to take the pencil you used earlier, and I want you to circle three words. Better than that, four. Verse 4, circle the word here. Hear, O Israel. Verse 5, circle the word love. Verse 7, circle the word teach. And verse 13, circle the word fear. All four are imperatives. They're commands.
Moses, the spokesman, talking to these people, gives them guidelines regarding family life in a pagan world. By the way, before we look a little, just briefly at each of those, and then we're through. Take the time to understand why I'm talking about this today, and why Moses talked about it centuries ago. Verse 24. Why would we take our time? So the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always and for our survival. That's the reason. This is for your good, men and women. This is for your survival. This is for your children's good. This is for your children's survival. This is for our grandchildren's good and for our grandchildren's survival. Four guidelines to help us on our way. First, hear the truth continually. Verse 4. Hear the truth continually. It becomes a major task for every family that wants to be preserved through pagan times, and that's all of time. A major task to make sure we're hearing the truth continually. You are being barraged with propaganda. You're all very intelligent people. Hopefully you're able to filter truth from lie, essential from incidental. If you are not, you are hopelessly awash. It requires discernment, ears perked up like a Doberman pincher, listening for the right sounds. We are to continue to hear that which is truth. We hear it from tapes that we play. We hear it from radio programs we listen to. We hear it from sermons that are delivered. We hear it from Bible study teachers. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't let anyone tell you that you're going to get spiritual indigestion. That's crazy. If you stopped eating because you're overweight, most of us haven't. We still eat. We still come to the table. We're going to do it in 15 more minutes. We still need food. We still need nutrition. We still need to take it in. We still need the truth from God that continues to come to our attention. It helps shape us. It helps build that necessary wall of defense. It keeps our discernment keen. We keep getting more insight. I was in the life of David this week in the chapel all 4 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, called of God, challenged by the giant, tested from within, tempted from without. All four passages are known so well to most of the people in attendance, but it's remarkable how you get back into the text of Scripture. There's more, there's more, there's more, and more, and more. So many, even faculty said to me, I never had that insight in that before. Or some student who said to me, I've done a study in the whole life of David. He's a fourth year student, about to graduate. He said, some of the things you pointed out just passed me by. It's not that I'm that insightful. It's all there, but we have an infinite text. And this infinite word of God is to be heard and applied. Hear the truth continually, folks. The second, love the Lord fervently. That's verse 5. You shall love the Lord your God. How? With all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Boy, I think there's passion in those words, isn't there? Isn't it sad to be around Christians who've become jaded? They've heard it and heard it, and they've stopped applying it, but they keep using the words and the cliches, and it means nothing to them, but they've become religious in place of Christian. Is that tough for you to be around as it is for me? He says, love the Lord fervently. Did you see it? With all your heart, soul. I'm so glad I married a woman like that. Forgive me, honey, it's going to embarrass you, but I'd say it if you weren't here, so might as well say it while you're here. I say to her sometimes, you are so pure, it's like living with Mother Teresa. Unbelievable. Incredible. She just has this incredible love for Christ and love for truth. I mean, there are times I'm not quite there. You know what I mean, guys? Sometimes the light's really a little more pink than red. And you just kind of scoot by. I can count on it. Cynthia would say, you ran a red light. And I said, honey, it's not red. It's like almost. It's changing. It's in between. She says, it's red. It's red. My kids kid me about that sometime. And I've deserved many more tickets than I've gotten. I want you to know. I started off right in Texas. I got one a week after I arrived. So I am really, really watching. I was driving our daughter down. She's just getting over the flu and a bad case of this thing. And she was feeling a little better. I said, let's go get some yogurt. So Colleen hopped in the car with me. We're driving along. And I don't know why. I'm just driving a little bit faster than I normally drive. And I got to one of those lights. The yellow thing doesn't last as long as it used to, I've noticed. And so I just kind of scooted by, and she said, Dad, you ran a red light. I said, honey, you're like your mother, you know? It's not. So I look, and there's a light flashing on a car behind me. And she said, great, this is great. I'm going to be in the car while you get the ticket. So we pull over, and this officer walks up, and he says, good evening. I said, good evening, sir. How are you, sir? Nice to see you, sir. And he said, may I see your license? And I said, yes, sir. I've got it right here, sir. And I showed him my license. And my daughter said, give him a ticket. I said, hey, Max. He deserves it. I said, it's Colleen. He looks at me, he says, Swindoll. You wouldn't happen to be. And Colleen says, I cannot believe this. I cannot believe this. Says, my wife would never forgive me for giving you a ticket. So here, you just got to watch those red lights. Colleen said, he deserves a ticket. It was one of those moments of grace that I enjoyed. Remarkable how your children hold you to the line. I know. It's been happening over the years. We're to love the Lord fervently. There is something about this that gets into every nook and cranny of your life, isn't it? I have a friend, Clyde Cook, who is president of Biola University, wonderful guy. He and his wife, Annabelle, were at SeaWorld some months ago, and they were walking along together, and they decided not to go to one of those events where you watch fish do things that they were never intended to do, and they thought they'd just enjoy the walkway. And he said, I looked up and I saw the strangest sight. I saw a whole flock of ducks on roller skates coming toward us. And Clyde, who has a terrific sense of humor, said, I stood there and I looked at them and I watched them getting closer and closer. He said, I could tell when they were right on us that they could do it, but they didn't have their hearts in it. I love that story because we have a saying in our home, he's a duck on roller skates. You can do things, but you don't have your heart in it. Love is an example. Love Christ, but don't be a duck on roller skates. Love him fervently, deliberately. Don't be afraid of that. Your kids love to know that love for Christ is a deep-seated thing. When you fail, you say, I failed. I blew it. They don't expect perfection. They just expect honesty. They expect you to be what you're supposed to be, and when you're not, to say you're not. Love the Lord fervently. Third, teach the young diligently. Verse 7. You shall teach them diligently. Now look at the verse. Look at it as if you've never seen it before. There's not a word in here about the temple or the church or the synagogue or Sunday. This is lifestyle. Teach them diligently to your sons, and you shall talk of them. Notice where this happens. When you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. What have you just read? When you're awake, when you're living your life alongside your kids and your grandkids, teach them. Teach them. It's a very natural thing. It isn't didactic teaching here. It isn't a set of notes that you're mimeographing and having them memorize. It's not that kind of teaching. It's a teaching that unfolds out of life. The most significant adult male in my growing up years was my maternal grandfather, whom none of you knew. He lived his entire life in El Campo, Texas. He was born on a covered wagon coming from Missouri to Texas. And he lived in El Campo all of his life. L.O. Lundy. Wonderful man. My older brother was clearly my mother's favorite. My older sister was clearly my father's favorite. And I was clearly my maternal grandfather's favorite. I remember his teaching me, though he never once said, "Now, little Charles, I want to teach you something." It was never done like that. He taught me how to be gentle with things that needed gentleness. He taught me how to think through things when I couldn't figure them out. He taught me that God was real and was worth my life. He's the one who taught me to drive. He's the one who taught me how to handle a motorboat. He taught me how to take machinery apart. He was better at putting it back together, but he tried to teach me that as well. When I stuck around him. I remember tearing off the front fender of his 39 Ford. I was learning how to park in the garage. He said, "Don't let it bother you. So I can always buy new fenders, but I can't buy new grandsons." Isn't that a great line? I'll never forget that. I remembered it when I hit the left fender a few weeks later. And then he talked to me a little bit stronger when I did that. There can't be that much problem in getting it right in the middle, son. But he taught me. He taught me. I'm trying to get you away from the idea that you do this on Sunday by hauling your kids to church and dumping them off down there at such and such a Bible church. You see, the church can't resurrect what the home puts to death. We tried to do that for over 30 years in my ministry and found that we never could get very much further than the home. If the home really believed the gal could get an abortion, it's the hardest thing in the world for us at the church to talk her out of it. See how that works? Because you've got influence over your kids that some youth pastor really in the heart of it all doesn't have. Unless you've completely so blown it that you've lost their respect. Teach them diligently. Well, I really do hope that you're as diligent about loving the Lord with all your heart around your family as you are at this conference. Because they deserve your best. We don't. They do. Because they're the ones you're shaping. And by the way, the idea that once you get the kids raised, it's all over. Boy, is that a joke? You get the kids raised, in some ways it's kind of starting all over again. It's just in a different category. It's a different philosophy at that point. I said to Cynthia the other day, "Honey, I'll tell you how we're going to handle it." And I named the couple, one of our four. I said, "We're not going to offer any advice until they ask. And when they ask, we're going to make up for lost time." But until they ask, we're not going to just come in like a flood. Because we got answers to questions they're not asking. And we've got to be careful here not to dump all of our grand and glorious wisdom on them if they're not ready for it. And we found it doesn't work very well at that point. When they were little, it did. I could shake a shoulder, or I could jerk an arm, or I could sit down and point a finger and all alone come to terms with some real stuff. I could even turn them over my knee and give them a whipping. But those days are over, long gone. But my teaching still goes on. Now it's teaching with wisdom. Sarah Teasdale put it this way: when I have ceased to break my wings against the faultiness of things and learned that compromises wait behind each hardly open gate, when I can look life in the eyes, grown calm and very coldly wise, life will have given me the truth and taken in exchange my youth. In the process of time, God has given you truth, and He's taken your youth in place of that. Now you must be very wise as you communicate that truth to those in your family. Because like one of you said, very, very, are we grading ourselves on now or on yesterday? Thank God we're grading ourselves on now. The problem is memories go back to yesterday. And we all made some bad mistakes that we would just do anything if we could to get over them. And finally, he says in verse 13, you shall fear the Lord your God and worship Him. Fear the Lord intensely. I think that's the one thing that's different in my life now, markedly different than 25, 30 years ago. I have a fear of God that I didn't have as a youth. I'm not afraid of Him, but I fear not honoring Him. It is my fear, which is more of a respect. I respect Him so much that there's just not the room I once had to disobey. I just can't quite talk myself as easily into disobeying Him. Well, if we all had it to do over again, wouldn't we do a great job of it? Wouldn't we have this put together well? Which reminds me of a wonderful little piece I read in my quiet time not long ago from Irma Bombeck that I'd like to close with if I had it all to do over again. This is a great little piece. Someone asked me the other day, if I had my life to live over, would I change anything? My answer was no. And then I changed my mind. If I had my life to live over again, I would have waxed less and I would have listened more. Instead of wishing away 9 months of pregnancy and complaining about the shadows over my feet, I'd have cherished every minute of it and realized that the wonderment growing inside me was to be my only chance in life to assist God in a miracle. I would never have insisted the car windows be rolled up on a summer day because my hair had just been teased and sprayed. I would have invited friends over to dinner even if the carpet was stained and the sofa faded. I would have eaten popcorn in the good living room and worried less about the dirt when you lit the fireplace. I would have taken the time to listen to my grandfather talk about his youth. I would have burnt the pink candle sculptured like a rose before it melted while being stored in the garage. I love it. I would have sat cross-legged on the lawn with my children and never worried about grass stains. I would have cried and laughed less while watching television and more while watching life. I would have shared more of the responsibility carried by my husband, which I took for granted. I would have eaten less cottage cheese and more ice cream. Way to go, Irma. I would never have bought anything just because it was practical. And all the women said, amen. When my child kissed me impetuously, I would never have said, later, later. Now, hurry up and wash up for dinner. There would have been more I love yous, more I'm sorry's, more I'm listening. But mostly, given another shot at life, I would seize every minute of it. Look at it and really see it. Try it on. Live it out. Exhaust it. And never give back a single minute until there was nothing left of it. Father, what a faithful and gracious teacher you have been through our years. We learn our best patience. We learn our best lessons on patience from you. We mouth grace and we shuffle about attempting to live it. But you, Lord, you are grace personified. Thank you, Father, for our families, for lessons learned, for trials endured, for blessings that have come above measure, more than we ever will deserve. Thank you for those great teachable moments you gave us with our children, and you will give us with our grandchildren. Thank you, Father, for those whom we have called our father and our mother, our grandfather and our grandmother. Thank you for the model that they have left in our minds. May some things that we have heard today go with us, not just through this day, but through our lives, so that we might hear and teach and love and fear as we should, for Jesus' sake.